It's interesting that the book is called Bad Therapy, because even though it does have a good deal to do with therapy, it's not really a takedown of therapists or that institution. It's more about how therapy has like infiltrated schools and child rearing. It feels more like a parenting book to me.
Yeah.
And I went into it thinking it was going to disprove CBT or something.
That was sort of my takeaway too, is I feel like it's more useful of a read for parents than for people who are in therapy or considering therapy. I mean, it's useful for that crowd too. I think there's a lot to say there, but I think it's most useful for parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think there were relevant things on therapy though too. I think the fact that it's been sort of used as like a universal cure for every, you know, ill that, or
panacea.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone that's having like a bad time, you know, it's like that's the first thing that sort of gets recommended. It was also a really interesting highlight of how industries self-perpetuate themselves, right? And how like, you know, it's, I mean, all the old sayings like are so true. Like, you know, if you have a hammer, like everything looks like a nail. It's the same. Don't ask a barber if you need a haircut. Like it's the same exact situation happening here. And I think I personally did not know how prevalent this was. I mean, I don't know. I feel like maybe it's because people don't necessarily, you know, at least I don't know, like people that have kids who talk about their kids being put into these kinds of things, but I mean, it seems super prevalent, which is wild to me.
She never really gave a number or like,
she gave a couple numbers. Wasn't it like 40% of kids?
Yeah, there were some numbers. I have some highlights.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. Well, we should probably say the book today is Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier. Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. And the premise to describe this book is really, I think, interesting, and it grabs people really quickly, because I'll just read from the flap here. In virtually every way that can be measured, Gen Z's mental health is worse than that of previous generations. Youth suicide rates are climbing, antidepressant prescriptions for children are common, and the proliferation of mental health diagnoses has not helped the staggering number of kids who are lonely, lost, sad, and fearful of growing up. What's gone wrong with America's youth? And, you know, she asks this question of like, it's by far the most treated, therapized, mental health aware generation in history. And so why do they seem to be doing disproportionately worse than past generations? And her conclusion is that all of the therapy related interventions are actually the problem.
Yeah, I think, and there are some stats on this comparing it to the previous generation. So like there's a stat pretty early in the book where she says the rising generation has received more therapy than any prior generation. Nearly 40% of the rising generation has received treatment from a mental health professional, compared with 26% of Gen Xers. And then 42% of the rising generation has been diagnosed with a mental health, mental health diagnosis.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of her book is about the unofficial ways this also happens. So like the 40% figure is what's on the books. And then
yeah. You
have like the secret counselor meetings at school and things of that sort, which, you know, unclear how much more that is. Maybe it's 1% more, but something more.
Yeah. If not a lot more.
Yeah. yeah.
Really, I was being generous.
Seriously. Yeah. Yeah. Really feels like it's rampant in a lot of these schools. Yeah. When I heard about this book, it made me think of a stat that I had heard. This was in another book that we had read, and she referenced it in the book. I don't remember where I had heard it, but during World War II, when London was being bombed, I think that was where this kind of like informal study was done. Suicide rates went down dramatically. And it was this interesting question of, you know, it's certainly nobody in America is living a worse life than somebody who is hearing air raid sirens every night. I mean, okay, some people are living a worse life. The vast majority of people are not living a worse life than hearing air raid sirens every night, waking up and finding out that your neighbor's house was blown up and they're dead, right? Like that's just like an unimaginably bad reality from how we live right now. And people who entered into that situation, their mental health seemed to get better, right? Which is like kind of wild to hear. And it does raise this question of like, something about this problem is more complicated than just having a easier, lower conflict, simpler life leads to more happiness, more mental health, or better mental health, whatnot.
Yeah. There's also a element here of, and I was starting to allude to it, of just like incentives gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There was something early in the book too that she had mentioned, which was therapists vastly prefer the mildly mentally ill versus the like truly mentally ill. And, you know, the mildly mentally ill, she's like, you just have a conversation with them, you know, for 50 minutes a week. It's from a therapist's perspective, probably relatively chill versus like a violent schizophrenic, you know, is probably like the worst possible patient that you can get because there, you know, there's risk involved. And so, you know, from just an incentive standpoint, a therapist is incentivized to basically mint as many of these patients as they can. And there's, you know, because these are also mental disorders, these are not like, you know, there's no blood marker for having anxiety. Mm. It's there's an element of like the more you make someone aware of it, the more convinced they are that they have it.
Yeah.
Because there were some examples, I'm more maybe fast forwarding a little bit, but there's some examples of like the surveys that they use to sort of early diagnose or at least put someone into this pipeline. And those surveys are, they're almost like astrology, like something in there probably applies to you.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to say yes to at least one of those questions on any given day. And, you know, because it's not a blood marker, it's not quite a science that you have this or you don't have this. It's really a relative thing.
What's wild is that the areas in the book where they, like where she talks about the body keeps the score.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, yeah,
definitely have that on my list.
Yeah. I mean, she's just like, yeah, the science has just disproven this book.
Yeah.
Like, so the available science is undermining the thesis.
Yeah. I think like the broad thing that this book really does a good job of making you question is that it feels like our culture sees therapy as like an unquestioned good, right? Like, if somebody tells you that they're going to therapy, it's like you're kind of like proud of them or something, right? It's like, oh, that's great, right? Cosette was mentioning that she hears this on like, you know, some of the podcasts she listens to that are more just like, you know, girls talking about like work and life and dating and whatnot. And it's like a red flag if a guy isn't in therapy, right? Like, everybody should be in it.
Hmm.
And that mentality seems to be doing more harm than good. Especially for those reasons where it's like, yeah, if you get somebody talking about their feelings enough, you get the, you start asking these questions long enough, they will pretty naturally start to wonder, maybe I do have anxiety, maybe I do have some depression, maybe I do have something from my childhood that needs to be unearthed in these sessions so we can work through the trauma, blah, blah, blah. And that might just be making things worse.
It's almost anything that's born of a reactionary impulse. Like, oh, my dad kept everything bottled up his whole life. And this is not my dad, but like the hypothetical, like, oh, your dad kept everything bottled up his whole life. Like, he should have gone and talked to somebody. He would have been happier. So every time I encounter someone bottling something up, I would encourage them to go to therapy and celebrate when they do, so they don't end up like this figure who I saw. So it's a bit of a reactionary impulse, which makes it a little hard to know what is a good or bad amount of it. Like she says in the book as well, she's like, it's not bad for everybody.
Yeah.
Like totally. There are some set of people who should absolutely be going to therapy. But we've basically said, and it's not about just going to therapy, but like therapizing is maybe the more generic verb we should use, because it also includes, you know, teachers trying to attempt pseudotherapy in classrooms and counselors and people who are not trained professionals. But it's sort of become the first response in all cases. And it's very, I think like the main theme of the book is the main harm is it kills agency.
Yeah.
You've introduced a professional into the parent-child relationship who is now an intermediary to the parent-child relationship. You've introduced a professional that the child can create a dependency on and be unable to manage their own lives. And then once again, you've introduced a person who is telling the parent how to parent overriding the parents' own instinct. You know, the parents are the one in the house with the child.
Yeah.
So the parents now doubting themselves. So the kid is doubting themselves. The parent is doubting themselves. The kid is seeing the parents doubt and losing their trust in the parent. At the same time, they're losing trust in themselves.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about the parent thing at some point. But one thing just before that is this definitely also brings up the issue of like chronic versus acute treatment. And I think the same problem exists in the medical industry. It's like far more profitable to have chronic patients. And that is like the ideal customer, because it's like, you know, you're going to be taking that drug for the rest of your life. You're going to be in therapy for the rest of your life. It's very different if somebody has an acute problem and you're like, hey, you need, you know, 4 weeks of talk therapy and you're up and out, right? Yeah. But like, that's not a great business model. So a lot of this turns back into like, I mean, I keep going back to the incentives thing, but it's like the incentives are totally there to convince somebody that like, you just need to come here every week for the rest of your life. And this is like a vitamin that you need to take every week instead of something you need to do to solve a problem. And then you're up and out, you're out of here.
She does a good job of talking about the different kinds of therapy. So the most obvious one is physical therapy, right? If you mess up your back and you go to a PT and they give you the stretches and help you work through it, and then your back pain is gone, and then you can stop going to PT, right? But there's psychological versions of that, like CBT clearly works and is well studied, right? You know, you can use cognitive behavioral therapy for certain kinds of interventions. It can have like a massively positive impact, but there's a clear goal at the end of it that they're helping you work towards. They usually have a set amount of time to help you get there, and then you're done, right? You leave and you ideally don't come back. And like the other one she mentions is exposure therapy is another, you know, very well studied, very well documented type of therapy, seems to work very well for people who are, you know, seriously triggered by certain stimuli, and they have you go through the process and then you're doing better and then you can like move on with your life. And there's no, there's both no proof of that kind of efficacy for just generic talk therapy, nor is there that like completion point. It seems like, you know, everybody who I know who has gone to therapy and then stopped, including myself, they just sort of hit a point where they were like, I don't think this is actually doing anything for me. And then stop like
looking for stuff to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like trying to think of things to bring in here, right?
Have we all, so Nat, you've done therapy. I have done therapy.
I have as well. Yep.
Okay. So we all have some. Like, what were your experiences like?
I mean, I actually don't think I got much from it, but I've only tried one therapist for 4 weeks, maybe. So four sessions. I personally didn't get a lot from it. I got a lot more, and I know she talks about this as well, like the group type of session. I got a lot more from the group grief session that I did for like 6 months. And that was like a weekly thing for like 6 months. But I think that was, in a weird way, it was like exposure therapy, because the caregiving experience was very isolating, especially it was during COVID, which made it even worse. And just being in that group for 6 months made me realize like, oh, I'm not the only person that's had this happen. Like, and people are doing well after. So like, I can do well after. It was like a good exposure in that sense. But even that after, I would say like, you know, 4 or 5 months, maybe after 5 months, it started feeling like a chore. And at a certain point, I stayed in it for like a few more weeks just to like I felt like, oh, like maybe I can like give my experience now to like other people. But then after those 4 weeks, I actually thought it was harming. So I kind of agreed with what she was saying. Like, it was making me like wallow more. Then I felt good on the days that I didn't have it. And then the days that I had it, I would be like down again. So I think I kind of hit this point.
Recovered.
Yeah. I hit that point where I was just like, okay, this is actually not helping.
Yeah.
And then I left and haven't done anything since then. But yeah, I think like my experience with an individual therapist wouldn't have called it harmful. It was just not, I didn't feel like I got a lot out of it, but again, it's a very limited sample size.
Did you go into the individual therapy with like a specific goal in mind, or was it just like open-ended?
It was also during everything that was going on. It was like the part right before COVID. So I did go in person and the goal was basically to like try to come to terms with what was happening and just like, you know, kind of like we're already making a Tao reference, but just like accept reality. And I actually think that was not necessarily something that can happen externally, if that makes sense. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know. It was like, because my goal wasn't to like solve a problem necessarily. It was more just to like accept rather than like feeling like I'm fighting against something that's happening.
Yeah.
And honestly, like there, and this is, I don't know, maybe controversial, but I feel like with a lot of these problems, frankly, like time is your best. It's like time and then like actions that you can take end up being like the best therapy in a weird way. Like I actually would credit the gym more than even that like group therapy thing with feeling better.
Yeah.
Of just like really ramping up my physical activity. I felt like helped me so much.
Have you guys watched the Arnold documentary?
Not yet. I keep hearing it's good though.
He says this about when he lost his father and brother in a quick succession. And he says something very similar to that effect.
Oh, really?
Wow. But it's very endearing because he says it in like a very Arnold way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that. I felt like that helped. So like I would just make myself go every single day for like months, even if I was like tired and do something, whether it was just like, oh, I'm super sore, I'm just going to swim today, or like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm just going to run for a little bit. Like just like forcing yourself to freaking leave the house and just go somewhere and do something physical and sweat. You just feel really good doing that. And also you feel it just like, I feel like it builds confidence again in a weird way. Like, oh, I, as silly as it sounds, it's like you see there's like objective progress when you do physical activity like that, especially I hadn't really worked out for a couple years at that point. It's like in a concentrated fashion. And you go from like, oh, I can like bench this much to I can bench this much. It's like objective progress. And you feel like, oh, I'm capable of stuff. I don't know. I think that's like a very underrated, like, honestly, maybe they should be like prescribing gym memberships to people. Like, honestly, wouldn't be the worst thing. It's also very hard to be anxious when you're like physically in an exhausted state. Weirdly, you feel really good. Yeah. I mean, you guys know, like if you go on like a long run, you just feel amazing after, even though physically you're tired, but you feel incredible.
Totally. It's also a sense of control. Like it's sort of like every time I clean my house, I feel better.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not just because it's clean. It's like I can clean it and leave the house, but I've done a thing with my hands.
Some control over your environment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's agency. It goes back to that.
Totally. I went for about a year, I think. Maybe slightly less than a year. And I was going weekly, and I started out of a combination of this was back in 22. And so part of it was, I feel like this vibe has shifted a lot, even just in the last 2 years, but I started going, that was definitely when it felt like we were in peak, like everybody should be going to therapy. And maybe that was because of COVID or whatnot. But, and so there was a little, I felt almost a little bit like I was supposed to be doing it, like I was doing something wrong by not going. And I was just dealing with a lot of like, I was in like a fairly hyper anxious state, but I think, and like a lot of that I think was from all the crypto work and whatnot. But yeah, in terms of dealing with the anxiety and whatnot, I don't know that it actually helped nearly as much as like, exercise and whatnot as like acute treatments. It did help me get more comfortable just like talking about feelings, just in the sense of like, and I think that that can be one benefit is like, if you're somebody who, you know, didn't grow up learning how to do that, you almost need somebody to practice on, and having somebody who you're paying to help you practice that can actually be quite useful. But it got to a point where, one, I felt a lot more comfortable doing that and could do it with other people, which is, I think, really what we should be doing, right? Like you should be having these conversations with your partner or a trusted mentor or a close friend or something like that. And I didn't feel like it was providing any useful tools for like rumination or like bad thought patterns or like getting past old stuff or things like that. Like to your point, Neil, continuing to talk about them like wasn't helpful. Right. And the other thing that I found was interesting with it was like having gone deep, like fairly deeply down, like a few different paths around mental health now, I kind of feel like it would be in like maybe last place out of like psychedelics, some sort of religious practice, and like exercise and health stuff. Like the benefits from it did not feel nearly as significant as the benefits from the other three have. So that was kind of like why I stopped. So I was just like, and the other reason I stopped is I realized that as I ran out of things to talk about, I was using it to workshop articles where I would just kind of like, or like as a journaling session where I would almost just end up monologuing for an hour with like very little interruptions. And I'd be like, okay, that felt good, but I could have just like done this on my own or something. Like I didn't need somebody sitting in front of me.
Well, you probably got more comfortable talking about your feelings.
Yeah, too. Probably.
And then you probably hit a point where you're like, okay, I don't need another person across from me to do this.
Yeah. Or just like, I need better tools than you can get or than I could get from sitting and talking about it.
Yeah. Actually, something you just brought up sparked something for me where in the book, like I think she did a decent job of highlighting this, but I didn't connect the dots until just now, is that these are kids that she's primarily talking about. Yeah. And I think as adults, we can make that decision of, okay, I've gotten what I need from this, I'm out, right? Yeah. Or like, this isn't working, I'm going to try something else. And we have that agency and that control. But it's very different when you put a 12-year-old into therapy and your parents are paying for it and forcing you to go. You didn't choose to go. Your parents are making you go. And now you're just like at the whim of somebody who, A, you're probably in therapy because you're not comfortable talking to your parents about this stuff. B, there's a financial incentive for the therapist to make your mom or your dad feel like you need to continue. So you're kind of trapped in a way as a kid in this paradigm. And I think one of the points that she makes is like wallowing in this stuff actually can make it worse. Like it's not just a neutral intervention. So yeah, I think that's, I didn't connect those dots until like she definitely brought it up. I just didn't make this connection that like we are adults and we have had that experience and made that decision of like, okay, yeah, I got what I needed, I'm out, or I'm not getting what I need, I'm going to try something else. And a kid doesn't have that option at all.
Well, the one point she makes on that note, Neil, that I thought was really powerful is that one of the hallmarks of depression and anxiety is rumination. Constantly thinking about a problem, constantly replaying it in your mind, you know, worrying about it, thinking about it. And a lot of these interventions are like forced rumination. They're making you continue to return to it and continue to think about it and continuing to talk about it and continue to ask you, you know, how you feel about it and whatnot. And so they're almost like inducing some degree of depression and anxiety, like through the practice, which is especially concerning because it's really interesting, like from that lens of to what extent is this industry just propagating itself? Like, have you guys heard the term spiritual bypassing?
No.
So it's a term used to describe like diving into a spiritual or religious practice as a way of feeling better about, you know, yourself or your past, or like getting through some pain in your life, or, you know, addressing, you know, mental health challenges, things like that. But it's used in a negative sense because it's bypassing the problem. You're not addressing it. You're not working on it. You're not getting help for it. You're throwing yourself into faith or something as a way of coping with the situation. But it's kind of interesting because it's like, it's a term that was invented by therapists, right? And so it's sort of like, you know, it's used a lot as sort of like a condemnation of people who use, you know, meditation or religion or something to help improve their mental health instead of like doing the work to get through these past traumas or whatnot. And it's like, hold on, you invented a word to say that people solving this any other way than paying you $150 an hour to solve their problem is like a bad thing, right? You could imagine somebody listening to what you were saying, Neil, and saying, oh, well, you're physical bypassing. You're not letting your mind work on this. You're getting into your body instead and not like working through the hurt of what happened to you. And you actually need more therapy because the fact that you're trying to solve this by exercising is a sign that you're really deeply wounded. And
wounded and avoidant.
Wounded and exactly. Yeah. And so you know, once you're kind of like sniffing for these things, they're really easy to notice. And you start to wonder, you know, just how many of these terms are almost just like invented to propagate the practice.
I think I at least picked up the book with a pretty positive impression. So before we get too far from it, my experience with therapy was 2022 was like 8 months. But I worked with someone who I think probably could have authored this book. Mm. So she had all these biases that I thought were really helpful, which were we scheduled a fixed number of sessions for a fixed duration of time around a specific problem. We actually didn't meet every single week so that I wouldn't form like a dependency specifically on talking to her. Every time we did meet, it was halfway between therapy and coaching. Cool. Where it was a mixture of like talk and Q&A and like I got to ask and she got to ask and it was a bit more like a conversation of equals. And then there was also like there was some accountability. It was like, hey, there's a specific thing you want to change in your life and like what happened since the last time we spoke. And when it came to the ruminations and like thinking through some of the things that were beleaguering me at the time, she actually gave me a number of exercises I could do on my own, such that when our time together came to a close, I would have these exercises to go back to and I could sort of pick from my like bag of tricks for the ones that I wanted to do. And because it was a default expiring setup, we would only continue it in the event that there was like actually unfinished work. And in our case, I think we did it for like 6 or 8 months. And at the end, we wrapped things up.
That sounds great.
But it was like the most incredible. It was so helpful. And like, I still feel very, very grateful for what she did to me, but I think that was like the right amount. And there was a problem. It took like a year to solve and got solved a little bit after she and I wrapped, but yeah, I don't know. It was pretty, so I guess I came in with a lot of these biases, but I didn't realize how prevalent the alternative setups were. Like Neil, you were both just mentioning the financial incentives. It didn't really occur to me until I read the book.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like, we're here to help.
It's crazy. Like there's definitely a number of couples I can think of in my life where like both of them are going to therapy like weekly and they might be going to couples therapy on top of it. You're spending over $1,000 a month going to these therapists and, you know, depending on how good they are and what type of work you're doing, like there might not be any compelling evidence that it's going to help you in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely wild as a practice in that sense.
Yeah. I think obviously everything is, a lot of these things are a spectrum, but the other thing that it kind of teaches you is, and this is, I don't think the right lesson for most people, but teaches you to take your feelings a little bit too seriously in some ways too, because was something that I hadn't realized till reading this book. And I was like, yeah, that's actually a really good point that like Nat is probably going to drop a reference here soon. But it's like when you meditate, right? Like the fleeting thoughts that come, you're supposed to just let them go. And that's actually a really good practice for real life too, because thoughts are not necessarily real.
Yeah.
Right. Like you could have a thought and that doesn't mean that's like what it is. And like, everybody has had times in their, you know, when they think of something of like, oh, this person did something that I don't like, or like I'm mad at this person. That doesn't mean you hate that person forever. It's just like a fleeting thought and like, you know, you figure it out. But I think when you, to your point about forced rumination, when you like, let's say you have a weekly standing appointment with your therapist, you go in and you're talking about the week and you're like, oh, I had this like, my mom's really been annoying me or whatever. And then you like talk about that for an hour. It's now not a fleeting thought. It's like a calcified thought that you've now thought about for like an hour. Yep.
Yeah.
It just leaves a much deeper like imprint on your brain, right? Because it's not just like this one-time thought. It's like you now had a one-hour discussion about this one-time thought. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like just a much more serious thing at that point. And your brain remembers that stuff.
Yeah.
I do think this goes back a little bit to the reactionary piece, though, which is like there's a subset for whom this is absolutely necessary. But when anything reactionary, you don't know where to stop.
Yeah.
She has this paragraph. She's like, how do you know whether to put your 13-year-old in therapy? Simple. Don't. unless you've exhausted all other options. If you must sign up your adolescent up for therapy, research the therapist as you would any surgeon. In all but the most serious cases, your child off is better off without them. In all but the direst circumstances, your child will benefit immeasurably from knowing that you are in charge and that you don't think there's something wrong with her.
Yeah. I don't know if we want to make this segue yet, but like that, I feel like leads into such an important meta point. You're hitting on this too, Neil, of this like internal versus external locus of control, both in individuals and parents. And it kind of feels like this book fits into a meta theme that we're seeing in like America right now of like redeveloping that internal locus of control and like internal locus of judgment, mm-hmm. where there've been all of these kinds of iatrogenics, these like harms by the healer, where we just like trusted people to tell us what to do. And you kind of have to reel it back. And it's interesting how deeply it has influenced parenting too, where people just trust whatever's on Instagram or like do whatever they see on social media and are really, really afraid to do the wrong thing. And so they're always looking for some expert to tell them what to do. And she makes a really good case here that that might often just be making things worse than if you went with your instincts or your own judgments. Hi, Harley.
I like how we have another animal guest star.
You guys are getting some pets, fourth, Neil.
I know.
Fourth host.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Nat, I think that's absolutely true. I think the other like meta theme that kind of this comes back to is like in some ways like the ancestral stuff, right? Like people knew how to raise kids for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Before therapy was a thing. And to be fair, there were probably more community aspects and I guess like tools available to you, like from a community standpoint than we probably have in America now. But I think there's like an attempt to return to that in some ways.
I hope
like
so.
This has the flavor of like, I don't know, like a canola oil or something. Like that's the vibe I kept getting of like an engineered solution to like a problem that we had misdiagnosed the cause of or something.
Yeah. Something we'd actually solved a long time ago.
Yeah.
We created the problem and then we created a worse solution for it. And
is there evidence that the trend is reversing?
No. I just mean the fact this book exists is like a sign that
I think
at least like people talking about it.
I think given how this book has been received on social media, I think there is this like growing suspicion. I mean, just like, you know, as a parent, I kind of had a bit of this spidey sense as I started hearing some of these things, like especially the whole gentle parenting concept that we'll get into in a little bit, but it did feel like a lot of, you know, the therapy obsession was partially rooted in people not wanting to take responsibility for their own lives in the same way that like the semaglutide Ozempic obsession, right? Is it's like, oh, thank God, like we don't have to be responsible for our own health anymore. We can like take this drug to fix it for us, right? Or like, you know, a lot of the pills and whatnot, right? Obviously there are severe cases of depression and anxiety that like do warrant medication, but like the majority of people who are on them probably should be doing like lifestyle interventions instead, right? It kind of felt like a lot of this stuff was falling into that same category of a like relief from responsibility, which, you know, to Neil's point, has been the trend in a lot of areas over the last couple of decades, which is like hopefully starting to reverse. But I mean, unfortunately, I think that it's going to reverse for a small subset of people who read books like this and listen to podcasts like this. And for a lot of other people, it's probably only going to get worse. But
I actually experienced that directly. So in 2022, when I was looking for, you know, the therapist coach, I also met with my PCP. I had just met this PCP, first time we were meeting, and I was talking to him about, you know, what I wanted to do and so on. And in that session, he offered to prescribe SSRIs.
No.
It was crazy. It was like a 20-minute consult.
That's wild.
And it was wild. You know, like if I had, I don't think I needed SSRIs that day or at that point. I needed like, I actually wonder if I had like gone through with it. Cause part of what she talks about in the book is they, you know, you, for non-serious cases like mine in 2022, you take SSRIs and you feel good about the situation you're in, and then you actually don't solve it.
Right.
Even though it was something you could have solved, and then you actually perpetuate this bad thing that you're in.
Yeah. If you have an abusive partner and you're really depressed about it and you take antidepressants, you're probably going to stay with the abusive partner. Like,
yeah,
they, instead of, you know, changing the situation.
Yeah.
But you always hear about the stuff on Twitter or whatever, where like people are prescribing these left and right, but I didn't believe it till I was offered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, Nat, unlike, so going back to like your Ozempic comparison, I mean, Ozempic is actually like very effective at helping people lose weight. It has, you know, the side effects. That's maybe fair. Another,
yeah, yeah,
another conversation, which, you know, there are many, and I'm not recommending anyone gets on it. But yeah, I mean, the true point of comparison, the part of what you said that I think is like 100% accurate is like, this is probably needed for like a small subset of people who might be like, let's say, incredibly obese, can't lose weight any other, like it's hard for them to move.
Yeah.
So you got to like get them down to a weight where they can move, and then sure, you can get them to move. But like, there's probably a use case for that drug that actually does make sense for some people. But then the vast majority of people that take it are like 50 pounds overweight and using this as like a shortcut.
Yeah.
And sure, there's side effects, but it will get those 50 pounds off very effectively.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there side effects? This is another area where it's like the PR has been too good. So there are,
I
straight up did not know there were side effects.
Yeah. There's a lot of side effects around like muscle loss and like people not being able to put the muscle back on after even they get off the drug, like permanent muscle loss. And then on top of that, there's like a lot of GI symptoms people get. Like, I mean, it might be like too nasty for the podcast, but like people like shitting themselves randomly, like with no warning. I mean, which is, that is probably like a whatever side effect. It's probably not like the muscle thing is actually like very alarming, because lower muscle mass leads to a lot of other problems later in life.
There's some hints that it increases suicide risk too. So there's like
There's definitely side effects, but it's not like an ineffective drug. Like it is effective at what, you know, what it does with side effects. The therapy thing is like wild, because it's almost been like, as the trend, and what she highlights is like the trend of therapy has increased, it actually seems to have like made the problem worse in a lot of cases. Yeah. And so it's, even the problem it's trying to fix, it's not even like doing that necessarily effectively, with the negative side effects potentially. There are, again, people that benefit from it, but you know, it's not.
Yeah, I think it's worth just doing a blanket caveat for all of our statements that like the 15% or however many percent of people who really, really need therapy should absolutely do it. And this is the over-prescribed majority.
I also think you can do it. I also think you can do it and just go into it with a healthy grain of salt, like you would, or you should do, I think, for any pharmaceutical intervention too. Like you shouldn't start taking a drug with the idea that like you're going to be taking this for the rest of your life. You should be like, I am a big fan of like, I mean, there's something huge to the ancestral stuff. And I think there's like a lot of really good stuff to learn from that. There is also something to modern medicine.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad we have antibiotics. Like if you get an infection, that I can just take like, you know, 10-day course of antibiotics and I'm good to go. Like,
I do think part of the harm here though, is that it's pitched as like, it's supposed to be a forever part of your life.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think it's like when you take an antibiotic, no one is telling you to take it forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it really feels like this is another thing that's standing in for what we lost with when we lost communities and some form of religion, right? It's sort of like the unbundling of communities and shared ideals and like trust or faith or something. Like, therapy swooped in to fill that gap really quickly for people, in the same way that like going to a gym sort of like became the new gathering spot and whatnot.
Yeah, I guess therapy is like a analogous to confession in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Confession, getting stuff off your chest.
Totally.
Not exactly the same, but like there's definitely a piece of it.
One of the counter arguments she addresses in the book, and I don't remember how she does, and I'm curious if you guys do, is the same way that like cancer screenings didn't increase the occurrence of cancer, just detected undetected cancers, saying that the increase in therapizing correlated with an increase in mental health crises of this sort doesn't mean that it was caused by it. But I remember she answers it. I don't remember how she answers that.
I mean, the clearest evidence would be the suicide rate. Like, it'd be one thing if we only had depression rates, but the fact that significantly more teenagers are killing themselves is pretty clear indicator that something is getting worse, right? And, you know, it's probably worth mentioning too that like part of how she got to this book was her previous book was about trans kids, and how that can probably be better understood as a mental health disorder than some like, you know, wonderful acknowledging of their sexual identity. And, you know, I think that's how she ended up researching all the stuff for this, because they kind of stem from a similar problematic root of this idea that all of your feelings and mental machinations are valid and should be endorsed and given attention and taken seriously. And like we've said a few times now, that's sort of a dangerous position to take, right? Because you do, I mean, one, you overreact to things and get emotional and might want to lash out in ways that you definitely shouldn't. You know, we've all probably had like bad or destructive thoughts that we shouldn't take seriously. And it's like, yeah, your feelings aren't valid all the time. And the idea that they are is actually way worse than saying like, okay, no, you just got to, you know, get over that or ignore that or let that go.
It's hard to know where the line is between being totally shitty to yourself and never taking yourself seriously, and then taking yourself so seriously that every thought is documented and discussed.
Well,
there's a spectrum like everything.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There's no like, you know, 33% of your thoughts should be taken seriously. There's no exact number.
It might be a Pareto efficient thing.
I mean, I think that it's sort of a, like, a, to me, it feels like this was a natural response. I mean, so, you know, it kind of started with like Gen X parents, right? So most of our parents are like young boomers, probably. And, you know, boomers and their parents and the generation before them were all like pretty stoic parents, you know, not tons of talking about your feelings, more tendency to like ignore things or sweep things under the rug, whatnot. And kids grew up feeling like, you know, they didn't get heard for their problems. Like some of this stuff started to get popular. You think about like the 70s and free love and free expression and all that stuff. And then like up through the internet and all of, you know, how much more visibility we got into other people's inner worlds. And so I think there was this extreme reaction of, okay, that was awful. We need to go completely in the other way. And we need to like elevate all feelings. When you talk about all feelings, we need to take this stuff super seriously so that our kids don't feel that way. And it was like too strong of a response. They went way too far in that direction. And hopefully what this leads to, this could lead to like two things, right? It either swings fully back in the other direction and we all become very stoic parents and never talk about our feelings and, you know, just smack our kids when they misbehave and, you know, restart the cycle, or you kind of like find the middle between the two extremes. And I think that's kind of like hopefully where it's starting to land. I feel like you see the same thing with all the vaccine stuff, where there was this, you know, for a while it was the like, you can never, ever, ever question a vaccine. Like vaccines are God. They, you know, you get every single one the doctor recommends. And if you, you know, question it, then you're like an evil person. And then, you know, COVID and other stuff. And some people took it far the way to the extreme where it's like, oh, all of them are bad and awful. And like, you shouldn't get any of them. Every single one is dangerous. And now it feels like it's starting to kind of settle into a better understanding of like, okay, some are definitely worth getting, right? Like, you know, mumps and measles and whatnot, like those are bad, we don't want those, but COVID is we you know, so if it's just like another one of those cycles of like between two extremes and then we find the happy middle, then, you know, it might be good that we had this period. I mean, it's not good, but it was at least, it's useful that we've seen both sides of this now.
It's funny. I muted every word I could think of related to COVID on Twitter.
Yeah.
And the vaccine. Same. So I that last swing that you just mentioned, never heard of it. I have no idea what the word is these days on the COVID vaccine.
I just mean even going to our pediatrician, she...
No, totally.
They present it very kind of like evenly.
I mean, something I have noticed offline that's come up more anecdotally is... Well, I don't want to get into a vaccine rabbit hole, but is more of my female friends... speaking about their experience after taking the vaccine. And that was something that those first 2 years was really, really low key. Like no one was really talking about it because it was against the gospel at the time.
Yeah.
And maybe at the time it was fine too, because it was like the risk to reward at a, you know, societal level still meant like you should all go get vaccinated. But now almost, I can probably think of like 5 or 6 conversations I've had over the last year where it's come up.
Yeah. That's a good segue too, because women's health is another really interesting example of this, where, you know, we grew up and our parents really grew up in this era of like the pill is the most incredible medication that's ever been created. And like every woman should get on it as soon as she's a teenager. And that's really swung back now, where now there are much more honest conversations about the side effects and the risks. And a lot of women are getting off of it and, you know, using alternative methods. And that too was like heresy for a while to question this drug.
Well, the pharma companies and the media are still doing their best to vilify that. This got controversial this past weekend.
Yeah, wasn't it like on WAPO or something? It was a big article.
Yep. There was a Washington Post article about like basically like making fun of women who get their advice from TikTok. And if you read the article, the advice was basically get off the birth control pill. And what's kind of crazy about that article, if you actually read it, is like the only doctor they interviewed was a male doctor. And it was like that's actually one of the things that a lot of these women bring up as a criticism, is that like these are all male, like largely male doctors. This drug is like, you know, they're never going to take it in their entire life. So obviously they've never experienced it and like what the side effects are. And there's no thought put into like a woman's perspective or the long-term perspective on it. And that's actually a lot of the people that they quoted in the article or mentioned in the article. If you go to like their Twitter page and look at what they're talking about, they're basically like trying to bring a woman's perspective to it. Like they're all female who are talking about it. And honestly, the advice on like TikTok or social media is not always bad. Like no. You can't just dismiss it because it's on TikTok. Like that seems like I don't know what the term for it is.
I wouldn't like object a bad to that argument. Yeah.
Seems like a very bad argument to say that just because it's on TikTok and you're in the Washington Post that you're right. Like that's like an appeal to authority that's just flatly, like completely wrong.
Yeah. You have to know especially, how to filter it.
The conspiracy theorists have been right on so many things.
Yeah. you've got to have a good filter, because the mainstream stuff is always 5 to 10 years after the TikTok and Twitter stuff.
Totally. But a lot of the TikTok stuff is also wrong. Exactly. So you can't just blanket follow it. You gotta can't have a say good just because it's on TikTok, it's wrong.
Totally.
Right? Like, I think that's a very bad heuristic too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, if you take your advice from the mainstream, like you're still eating, you know, 12 to whatever number of servings of grains a day, like no fats, no meats.
Dude,
like,
it took 20 years. It took 20 years from the first discovery of the harms of smoking for there to be any medical establishment warning against it.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. This stuff takes a long time.
Trans fats, it was like 40 years or 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you wait for the establishment to tell you these things are bad, you're already dead.
You're probably near the end of your life at that point. Yeah.
Oh man.
It is also the other thing with the birth control debate that's really interesting is the low bar. Actually, it's kind of similar to the therapy thing. It's like the very low bar for taking it. So, you know, one of the things that helps resolve is skin problems.
Yeah, acne.
And that is actually like an off-label use of the pill. I actually did an episode on Outside the System about this with somebody who's very well versed in this, and she works with clients now after they get off to like help them sort of stabilize their hormonal balance, especially if they're trying to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And that's like one of the biggest things that she talks about is most of her clients actually didn't get put on birth control for like stopping getting pregnant. They were put on it because they had a skin problem and their doctor was like, oh, just take this and it'll resolve your skin problem. And it works for that, frankly. It's just like a very probably unneeded intervention for something as simple as a skin problem.
Sleep, water, diet. Yeah. The other crazy thing with that is I feel like we were all told this story that, you know, if you're not on birth control, like you will get pregnant.
Yeah.
And I mean, I thought that cycle tracking and like fertility awareness was just total bullshit, like complete nonsense. Right. And then you look into it and it's like very, very well understood, extensive, you know, literature and resources on how to do it. And we did that for 3 years and, you know, never got pregnant. And then we just switched it up for 2 months and then did get pregnant. And it's like,
yeah,
it actually works exceptionally well.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And that's something that we knew for thousands of years and, you know, tried to psyop ourselves into thinking it didn't work because it's a great business to get somebody on a drug that they have to take every single day for 20 years of their life.
Yep. Yeah.
It's a little depressing.
It is, isn't it? But you know what?
Yeah, it's just,
we're coming out.
I do think though,
the age of iatrogenics is over. The great awakening has begun.
I'm
drinking raw milk and eating steaks.
Did I tell you guys raw milk?
Oh, yeah.
I'm lactose in every other context, but I can chug raw
milk. Yeah, we talked about it last episode. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, yep. Yeah. Dude, it's awesome.
It's great.
Yep.
I hadn't had milk in so long.
Making my own ice cream.
I do think in a weird way.
It's a good life.
Ice cream. You could have milk. You could have... What about cheese, Adil? Are you good with regular cheese or do you need... Like, cheese. Does that also give you problems?
I can have some cheeses. I haven't like quite figured out why. Like the raw milk cheeses are totally fine.
I was going to say, you can get raw milk cheeses. Yeah. Actually, it's very legal almost everywhere now. So
I mean, the farm we get the raw milk from has cheese.
Yeah,
as well.
But I mean, I'm saying you can even get raw milk cheese in like Trader Joe's now. It's like
is that right?
Everywhere. Okay. Yeah.
But I can have some other cheeses too without issue. And I haven't quite done like the A-B testing to figure out why.
I wonder if it's like the amount of fermentation.
It probably is. Yeah. I'm guessing it's that because the more hard cheeses have less lactose.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting.
Because that's more fermented because they're eating – the bacteria is eating the lactose.
I just carry lactase around now and I pop a few.
Or you just chug raw milk.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is the pharma industry still has you, Adil.
Oh, yeah, dude, lactase, I bought like a 30 pack of their little travel size ones so I can stop buying them like whenever I run out. I just have a pile. I'm in the claws of that.
I think raw milk, we should fact check me on this one. I think raw milk actually has lactase in it.
Yeah, because it doesn't die during the pasteurization. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That makes sense.
Because enzymes get denatured when you boil something or heat it up. I think raw milk actually has some natural lactase in it, which would make total sense. Like why you're able to digest it then.
One other point from the book that she made that I recently experienced, like personally, she's like, you should never make happiness a goal.
Mm.
And at most points in your life, like if you just do a spot check, you won't actually be happy because happiness is not meant to be a stable default state. Like your default state like is like a neutral, maybe hopefully neutral positive disposition for some people, neutral negative disposition, but it's not like happiness is not a sane expectation as a default state. In December, a friend had recommended this app to me called How We Feel. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. It is one of the most beautifully designed apps I have ever used. And what it does is it pings you randomly throughout the day some number of times, and then it asks you how you're feeling. And it gives you a quadrant of four general categories, which I think were like either high energy, low energy, and then positive, negative, something like that. So you could be like high energy, positive, high energy, negative, and then like low energy, positive, low energy, negative. And then once you tapped into a category, it would show you another larger grid of maybe like 60 or so words, each of which is in one of those quadrants. And in the beginning, I loved it because it was actually really improving my emotional vocabulary because the voice in my head is sort of, you know, a very simple man. He's just like, oh, I feel like shit. Oh, I feel great. You know, I was like, okay, I should like have better words for this. But the first few weeks, I was picking up all these new words to describe how I was feeling. But then, yeah, after a little while, I was like, this is making me feel worse. This was before I read this book. So in the end, I uninstalled it and deleted it because it was exhausting. And it wasn't even that. It was like maybe checking in on me 4 or 5 times a day. As my default was like sort of neutral positive. I didn't know what a good score was supposed to be like. It ostensibly gives you trends week over week, month over month of how you're feeling. And it's like, yeah, like, I don't know, January sucked. Like, well, it had to happen, you know? It is worth trying the app to really feel how it gets in your head.
Mm.
I guess for you guys, maybe not so much, but for anyone listening.
Yeah, it's interesting because like when I think about if I were looking back on a previous month, my only way of doing that would be to look at photos. And photos are almost always going to be like a positive reflection, right? But if I'm looking at a spreadsheet of my mood throughout that month, it's going to surface all of these like little annoyances or maybe bad things or bad days that I've just completely forgotten about. And which there is no utility in remembering, right? I always think it's insane when I see people who track their mood over time, like in a spreadsheet or things like that. It's like, why are you doing that to yourself?
Yeah. This is exactly what this was doing. It was really timestamping, location, feeling. Half the time I look back, I was like, I don't know why I felt tense. Maybe I was late to a meeting. Who cares?
Ran out of lactase. then you would feel loose.
That category. Yeah.
What else should we cover from the book?
One other, so the like internal versus external locus of control point, she had a very interesting section on race and how that applies. So, you know, one, like the point she makes is, you know, it's particularly for minorities, like as a society, we've obviously given like, and again, it, all this stuff, like there is truth to a lot of it, but that like, you know, when you have this belief that, okay, the whole country is racist, or like our society is what was the term, like structural racism?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like that. Like the structures are racist that are, this country was founded on, et cetera. Right. You're kind of creating this external locus of control if you are a minority and you're saying like, well, I'm not in control of my own life. It's because of all these external things and there's nothing I can do about that. And it creates helplessness, really. And honestly, like despair when you feel helplessness. Have either of you guys ever seen the movie Coach Carter?
Oh, long, long time ago.
Yeah, it was from when we were probably like 12 or 13 or something when it came out. I don't know. I remember I was in like middle school and you guys are a couple years younger than me. So it was, you know, probably like 2003,
I think I watched it in 2004 school, maybe. Right, go ahead though.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched it in school because it was some inappropriate scenes, but
maybe not. Okay.
For a middle schooler, but it was a very good movie. It's based on a true story. So it was in Richmond, California. Very bad area where the school was, a lot of like gang violence and drugs and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. They had an alum who was a previous All-American basketball player. They brought him back to coach the team, and he actually created really high expectations for people. So like the school system only required you to have a 2.0 GPA to be on the team. I think he required like a 2.7. So it's like still reasonable, but it's not like he's basically raising the standards on everybody. And basically saying, if you want to play basketball, these are the things you have to do. And it's, you know, you have to attend all your classes. The school wasn't tracking attendance. It's particularly for athletes because they were viewing athletes as like the separate crowd. So he's like, you got to attend all your classes. I've asked all your teachers to take attendance for you specifically to see if you're there. You have to maintain a 2.7, I think is what it was. You have to sit in the front row of your classes. Like basically you just have to like try in school. And his point was, you're probably not going to the NBA. You're just playing basketball in high school. Like, you know, you got your whole life ahead of you, and really just trying to like change the mentality. And it was really interesting just to see how the players obviously reacted to it. Cause first they rebelled against it. The ones that left, there's some players that left the team, some players stayed, and the ones that stayed, like you know, it's just like you saw the transformation when someone actually holds them to a very, very high standard. You know, he would kick people off the team if you did something bad. Someone gives him attitude, makes him run. He makes them run, like basically just like shaping them from like, you know, kind of little boys to like men. And the cool thing is the movie ends with sort of what the players ended up doing after. So there's like the little montage of like, here's what they did after. And it shows their real pictures and stuff. And a lot of them actually went on to like pretty like solid lives. Like one guy, I think, like owned a car dealership. Another guy was like, you know, in a management position. It showed like what colleges they all went to college, which was amazing because at that school, it was like very few people go to college. And the ones that do are almost always girls, not boys in that school. So it was like all of these guys went to college. Some of them played basketball in college. So it's like really it was transformed their That's whole awesome. Life. And I always see that, like that movie just kind of sticks in my head because it really ties to what she was saying of like, and ties actually into the parenting stuff too, which I definitely hope we get to, of just like not like just giving in to someone's whims. It's actually not the best for them. And they're kind of hoping for someone to take the reins, basically. Yeah. Like people like, kids especially need that and crave that. And a lot of these guys didn't have fathers actually on the team either. It was very rare. Actually, the vast majority of the team was single mother parents. Hmm. So that was like another competing factor there.
On that note, like in the book, do you remember that section about kids who grew up in like very liberal households that are super lenient with the rules? It's like, what she's saying is a disproportionate number of kids who run off to join Islamist or white supremacist groups are from these like super
or Antifa.
Antifa. Well. Yeah. Like all of these extreme ideological groups disproportionately come from like very liberal, no rules households where there's no expectation set on the kid. And so they're like desperate for somebody to like expect something of them, which is, it's super interesting. I mean, I think that's true for adults too. Like, You hear about people who work for Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or any of these guys. And the story is always very similar of like, yeah, he's kind of an ass and like hard to work with, but the expectations are so insanely high that it like makes you want to do the best job possible. And that's extremely motivating, which is
the reporting is always so negative, but it's like,
but yeah,
I think it fits into the exact same narrative as this.
Exactly. People want to be held to high expectations.
This is sort of what discipline is, right? Yeah. It's like as a kid, your parents discipline you and they set expectations on you. And then as an adult, you set expectations on yourself. And if you don't, then you are undisciplined.
This is like, I think this is a good segue into like the whole gentle parenting stuff, because she comes down really hard on that. And like, you know, it's gentle parenting is almost like a super therapized approach to parenting where whenever your kid is acting out or melting down or whatnot, you know, stop and get down on their level and say, you know, I see that you're feeling upset, you know, how can I help? Or, you know, what can we do about it? You never say like, hey, get it together or cut it out or, you know, go to your room or anything. And I was hinting at this before. I always had this like little sense that there was some nonsense in that, just because, like, you know, there's not necessarily anything wrong with rules. She does a good job of laying out the difference between authoritative and authoritarian, right? Like an authoritative parent is one who has clear expectations and holds their kid to them, but is still, you know, compassionate and loving and everything. Whereas authoritarian is just bossing them around all the time, you know, for good or bad reasons. And, you know, I know at least one couple who had a kid who was like really, really having behavioral issues as a toddler and, you know, was like getting kicked out of preschools and, you know, all these problems, was like kind of a menace. They were really struggling with him and they were trying to do all of this like gentle parenting stuff to try to like help him, and like none of it was working. And so they went the complete opposite direction, found a coach, basically coach slash child psychologist, who advocated for like a much stricter, you know, much more authoritative, like, you know, the rules are completely unbendable. And if you break them, you will like immediately get punished, like no second chance, not like spanked or hit or anything, just like, you're going to go to your room, like you're going to no longer get to play with this toy, like any of that. And they said it was like night and day, like within days, they were starting to see these like huge behavior changes. And it was a pretty strong example of like, again, yeah, I mean, it's like kids want boundaries, right? They want rules.
I feel like we've known forever,
yeah,
as a species,
totally,
that there's like at least two phases in a kid's life, somewhere in like the 2 to 5, and then again as teenagers, where you're literally trying to push against boundaries, and the job of your family and society is to inform you of where those boundaries are.
Yeah.
Like they don't exist within you. They're not there to be discovered, you know, yep, inside your heart. It's like, no, the, you know, your parents or the deli guy or someone has to be like, yo, no,
cut it out. Yeah. You can't do that. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think that her point about how parents are, one, abdicating responsibility by trying to be totally gentle all the time, they're failing their kids, and two, they're failing their kids by outsourcing it to school and therapists instead of being, you know, a source of discipline and like a role model and all of these things themselves. I think she did a really good job of like framing that and explaining it.
There is also a cultural thing here with like Gen X and millennial parents. She doesn't get into it in the book, but like clearly there is some, you know, generations have stories, and there's some story with this generation of parent that it's like very deferential to this sort of authority and not very confident in themselves. And maybe part of it is like a post 70s, like throwaway tradition. So this is part of that. And we just starting from scratch and we're trying new things, but she doesn't really get into it in the book, and I don't have any good theories to insert there, but it feels like that's a thing. Like you have to convince the parent that this is an idea, and the parents were very ready to be convinced.
Well, to your point about the parenting styles of the generations, there was one point she makes of like, it would be one thing to be deferential and not hovering, right? And like deferential and like letting your kids do what they want, but then truly letting them do what they want and like, go do whatever you want. And I think her point was that kids will figure it out then. Cause like, mm-hmm, you know, you can't be an asshole for too long before somebody hits you, or like, yep, before, you know, even if you're just being an asshole to other kids, like some kid is going to hit you and you're just going to learn where those boundaries are if you're just on your own. And that's maybe how it was done in earlier generations where like, you know, I wasn't alive in the friggin' like 50s and 60s and stuff, but from what I've read, like, parents, you know, kids would like go out and play and like be gone all evening, and then they'd come home and whatever they did during those hours, like parents had no idea what was going on, but like kids sort of figured it out where those boundaries were. I think the difference now is that parents are deferential, but they are still very micromanaging of their kids. It's like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, because she really advocates.
It's one thing because you see a lot of micromanaging with immigrant parents for sure, but they are not deferential at all, right? It's like immigrant parents can be like very micromanaging, but they are not going to let you get away with anything. So there's like, so you're getting the worst of one side, but the best of the other. And I think in the sort of status quo right now, at least from what I've learned from the book, is just that like people are kind of getting the worst of both.
I'm looking up the generations in the fourth turning because he speculates, they speculate on how they will be as parents. And for Gen X, it is overprotective.
There you go.
There we go.
Well, yeah.
Transition to midlife, frenetic to exhausted. Dude, I mean.
Fourth turning
is a little hokey.
Battered mommy
like,
syndrome, remember? Yeah. In the book? Yeah. Battered mommy syndrome.
Oh, I don't remember that one. What was that?
Oh, that was like a whole chapter, or like a whole section of a chapter. Mm. Yeah, where the kids are like hitting their mom.
And oh, in this book. Just, in this book.
Yeah, in this book.
Yes,
this book.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was in the fourth turning.
No. I was saying, but like exhausted, like, yeah.
I mean, I sort of have another, like, she didn't really talk about this in the book, but I have a small theory that some of this problem also stems from having fewer children. In the sense that when you have fewer children, you can allocate a lot more attention to each of them. And in doing so, it's easier to like magnify things and to feel like you have to solve every problem and you have to get involved in everything. Like, I even noticed it going from 1 to 2, where it's like, once you have 2, the amount of time that you're willing to let one of them be unhappy, like, just naturally increases. And like, they have to figure it out a little bit more on their own, because you simply don't have the hands or attention to address both of their needs immediately. But if you, like, if you always just had one kid, you could always be hyper fixated on their needs and be like obsessing over them in that sense. But if you have like six kids running around, you have no idea what most of them are doing most of the time, especially if it's one parent raising them, and like, they have to figure it out. And that's where like that difference between expectations and micromanagement come in, are like, yeah, you're on your own most of the time, but I have very high expectations for you, versus like, you're not on your own and I'm going to tell you what to do all the time, because like, I have the capacity to do it. And so I wonder if that has played a role at all. And I almost wonder if like, I'd be really curious if they had this data. It didn't come up in the book, but I would be curious to see the incidence of these issues in kids from only child households versus households with like four or six kids. And my bet would be it's lower the more kids there are.
Totally.
Yeah.
At that point, the kids are raising other kids.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which like that kind of goes back to another point she makes in the book, is that like the kids do a lot of it themselves, right? Like the parents, I think, overestimate the extent of their influence and their control. And so it's like, you can definitely get in the way, but you can't necessarily like make them progress, but you can like provide guardrails, and you can definitely like get in the way or obstruct things. And so oftentimes it's like, yeah, you do need to get out of the way and like let them live and let them figure it out. And again, if you're like hyper fixated on one kid, it's probably a lot harder to get out of the way when you physically don't have time to be in all of their ways. Then it's a little easier. It's
also the like, you don't have grandparents around anymore,
yeah,
or like families are far apart. Like the nuclear family definitely exacerbates this.
Totally.
Because, you know, my grandparents lived with us for a couple of years, and then after my grandfather passed away, my grandmother moved to California and lived with us. She definitely played a big part of what would have been outsourced to someone paid.
Yeah.
We have like a fight with our parents, and instead of like going to my therapist to talk about it, she will have witnessed it from the other room. She'll come, she'll be like, "You okay? You should go apologize to your mother." You know, like she kind of play that role, because the parent can't be like, you need multiple voices to the kid,
yeah,
to negotiate the parent-child relationship as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
There's a great story. This is a few minutes back. I didn't want to interrupt, but you were talking about like immigrant parenting styles. One of the rules my dad was really, really adamant about when I was in high school was, do not get in another teenager's car. Hmm. There was a time, you guys both know this story, so I'll give the abridged version so that others have context, where a friend and I climbed this mountain and there was some private property at the top, and we crossed that fence and got arrested. And when I got home, and like the cops called my parents and they were distraught and upset. My mom was very upset. And I got home. My dad had nothing to say about the mountain or the private property. He was just like, yeah, you're 17. You're going to do dumb shit. But then he looks at me. He's dead serious. He's like, but how did you get there? And I got punished for the car.
Honestly, it's a good
rule. It was great. Yeah. I thought it was great. Yeah. Whenever I reflect on it, it brings a smile to my face.
I like that. I respect it.
What did you get punished for that?
For the car, yes.
For the car.
Not for climbing the mountain, crossing private property, or getting arrested.
Honestly, I agree with your dad in that case. Like,
yeah.
Because the climbing the mountain private property thing is like, okay, you got enough of a consequence with the cop, but like, you didn't get a consequence for the car, and that was actually so like the trespassing thing, that's like society's problem. You know, society dealt with you on that. But
yeah, I never did it again.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, she kind of alludes to some of this in the book with the whole immigrant parents thing, right, that she was talking about, where I think, and there's obviously downsides to this, and I don't know, there are, like, Adil, I don't know what your experience was, but, like, there are, like, people who talk about this in, like, South Asian culture where, like, you know, they kind of, like the reactionary response to, like, their immigrant parents. But, like, Nat, to what you were saying with, like, when you have more kids, your parents just don't have time to, like, dote on you, I guess, as much, or like micromanage you as much. I think that's actually pretty true with immigrant parents too, because you don't come to the country with a whole lot.
Yeah.
I know, like, my mom worked the entire time when I was a kid, and like, you know, and I mean, she stayed home when we were like super young. Then she would work and my dad was working. So like, we'd always come home, like there'd be nobody home for, you know, a good chunk of our school years. And like, we weren't micromanaged, but we were kind of micromanaged in a way where like, we had these rules. Like, one of our rules was we're not allowed to play video games during the week. And like, I tried every tactic I could get to like get around that rule, where like I would try to play my dad off my mom. I would call my dad and be like, oh, she's not picking up. Like, can I play? I just make up these things. There'd always be like these random loopholes too, that you could play on certain loopholes. Like, got really, you know, really good grades, like they might let you play. So I'd always like try to find these like random loopholes. Never worked. And if you ever violated that rule, like it was a big problem. Like, you get in big trouble. And like, they knew that's the thing I wanted to do the most. So there was like one time, I forget what I did. I did something like, must have been bad. And I remember the punishment though. And the punishment was, I can't play on my PS2 for a whole month. Oof. Which to me, it's like 4 weekends gone from this thing. And like, you know, it was just a bad punishment. And, you know, I think like one of the things that she brought up in the book is like, parents are very unwilling to like truly punish their kids. And I got slapped and stuff as a kid, and it was fine. You know, I don't like it's funny, because in hindsight, it never actually hurt. Yeah. Those slaps, it's like the emotional pain that you would get from it. And, you know, it's like, I don't know. I think she brought up a good point about that, where like previous generations did that. I don't know where I sit on that. I don't have kids yet. I don't know where I sit on like the, you know, slapping your kids or whatever. But I think the idea of punishing your kids seems to be like, you need to be able to do that. Cause otherwise, how would a kid know what the consequences of bad actions are? Like, if you just,
I can't even believe this has to be said.
Yeah. I mean, if you try to reason right, like, with like, your kids, like, a lot of the quotes she was giving in the book, right? She was like, they were like, oh, the parent is trying to explain to their kid what they did wrong. Like, a kid doesn't understand that.
Yeah.
Kid does understand if you lose your video games for the next month, though. Like, they're not going to forget that. It was also doubly painful because my brother got to play. And I was like super annoyed at that.
Did you get to watch, or
I didn't have to watch, but I just knew he was playing. Oh, actually,
that would be hilarious. You're like outside of the window, like just watching him have fun. It's like raining.
quick tangent on how the loopholes worked. My favorite loophole would be, I was allowed to play on the weekends, and I was also only allowed, in theory, to play an hour. They were very loose with the hour, though. Like, it wasn't, that part wasn't strict. But just to be safe, what I would do is wake up super early on the weekends, like 5 a.m. level nice. Early.
I like the
because I knew they would like, I knew they would sleep in, right?
Yeah.
So like, they might wake up at like 9, and then they'd be like, oh, how long have you been awake? I'd be like, oh, I just woke up. So I'd get another hour.
So funny.
I was a freaking crackhead for video games.
I love it. It's where your entrepreneurial instincts were born.
Yeah. It's like, as long as I get up early, Jocko style, I can like
exactly.
play it longer video games.
Morning routines of this CEO, 5 a.m. video games.
Video games.
I do think like there's the whole like parents doting on kids thing. There's a bit of like, what is the, like, I don't know what the right way to word this is, so I'll stumble through it. You guys can correct me. But what is the point of a family, right? Like, what is the point of having and raising a child? It's like, the parent's role is to prepare the child for the world. When the child is prepared, you get like a couple of decades where you get to enjoy each other's company. And then there's a point where the child then prepares the parent for their death.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, that is at its core, the nature of that relationship, as I perceive it, at least. And I don't think doting is a tactic. It's not the end game.
Yeah.
Right. And I think there's a bit of this like Gen X millennial, I have to be a perfect parent. And instead you have to like go in and be like, no, I'll probably like fuck some number of these things up, right? Like, it's not going to go great, but I will do my best and I will like solve this objective. Yeah. So you no longer have the impossible expectation and you have a clearer idea of the goal.
she did a good job of, I think, like pointing out where some of that idea comes from and how it's partially also entwined with all of this therapy obsession, because people go to therapy and they talk about how they're anxious or they're, you know, having trouble with work or whatnot. And then it so often comes to this, like, well, you know, how did your parents treat you growing up? Or like, how did your parents make you feel as a child? And then the people get in their heads that, like, oh, well, my parents screwed me up. And so now I need to be hyper vigilant with how I treat my kids. So there's no chance of me screwing them up because I don't want them to, you know, feel towards me the way I feel towards my parents. And so they get super neurotic. And it, like, it goes back again to the problem with, like, this rumination and, like, scab picking. Because if you, like, you know, imagine if, you know, like, if you had a very Christian approach to it as something of, like, deep forgiveness, right? Where it's like, you know, these things come up and then you just forgive your parents and, like, allow yourself to move on, then you're going to go into parenting again, like you said, to deal with that mindset of, like, I'm going to screw things up, but if my kids are raised with, like, the same approach towards life, like, they will forgive me for it too, right?
Yeah.
And, like, you're exactly. going to just try your best. It's like those mental models are so important for how you deal with, like, those kinds of things yourself, or how you're going to be able to, like, pass them on to your kids.
The forgiveness thing is so huge. It's like having an outsider suggest when to cut off a family member is just,
that's wild.
I mean, it's immoral.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really feel qualms saying that. Like, it's just wrong. Like, that's a very sacred relationship to be interjecting in, and it should be done very, very, very carefully.
Yeah. And all this stuff with schools, like asking kids, you know, how much do your parents make your feelings feel seen? You know, do you feel like you can always bring your feelings up to your parents? Like those questionnaires they were doing. It's literally, yeah, it's like a struggle. Yeah. It's like a struggle session.
Struggle session. Is the microphone catching the purring?
No, he's good.
This is our second cat co-host today. This one's Archer.
Oh, Archer.
But yeah, those questionnaires, I don't recall ever doing anything when we were in school.
No.
That's got to be like a new thing.
Yeah.
That would have scared me. I was imagining how I would have handled that if I was like 10 and hearing about it. Because I didn't even, there was a really good point made in the book that, like, it's not that the survey itself, it doesn't have to be worded in a leading way. It can be worded in a perfectly neutral way. It still reveals the ontology of the world.
Yeah.
Which is like, these are parts of the world. And like, I was very naive to that until a somewhat older age. And I actually think that's healthy when you're a kid.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in high school junior year, and it was a relatively small school, it was like 850 students total. One girl did commit suicide, and it, like, we had an assembly and, you know, they told us what happened and they, you know, said that, you know, where to seek help if anybody wanted to talk about it and, you know, like how to support the family and things like that. And then they just let everybody move on. You know, it didn't become, and that was like a good thing, right? It was like, if you need support or if you want to talk about this, if you want to help, here's how you can do it. Like,
yep.
And now everybody go back to classes and sports, right? And like, I think that was actually kind of the ideal way to do it. It didn't turn into this thing where, like, okay, now every week we need to check in on everybody and see how they're feeling, right? Whatnot. It's like, it goes back to the trusting kids to be like somewhat competent, right? It's like, you know, yes, this happens, but, you know, here's how you can look for help if you need it. We are not going to assume that everybody needs help all the time and needs to be like diligently monitored to, you know, reduce the risk as much as possible.
It also instills doubt. Like, if they had been checking in on you, let's say every month, how are you feeling? And you're feeling okay, then you might feel guilty. You're like, should I be feeling bad?
Yeah.
Are others feeling bad?
Or other people must be feeling really bad. Like, should I be feeling worse about this? Right. Or should I be feeling worse in general?
Yeah. And then you can like psyop yourself into feeling worse.
Totally.
Yep.
Or starting to feel guilty that you're not feeling worse is the other downfall that you could have.
I mean, the social media aspect of this is so powerful too. She talks a little bit about it, but all of these manufactured existential crises are like, you know, people being depressed about climate change, right? And if you look at any of the stats, there's literally no reason to be worried about this as an existential threat. But if you open up Instagram every day and one of your friends from school is posting about how they're just crying and so sad and scared about what the future is coming to and, you know, blah, 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 then you're going to start to feel like, oh, I'm a bad person if I don't feel this sad about this thing too. And that's definitely...
What's the whole... It's like rewarding emotional suffering. Totally. So it becomes a dopamine hit in a way.
Yeah, there's, I mean, the climate change thing was really interesting too, where she was talking about it's often anxiety that's going from parent to child. Mm, like if you hear that all day in your home, that, you know, you're, and I bet, you know, she didn't talk about this, but I bet it applies to the conservative side too. Like if you're constantly worried about like, oh, like Biden's going to do this or like whatever is going to, Bill Gates is going to, you know, chemtrail and destroy the environment or whatever, like whatever like conspiracy theory you want to bring up. Like if a parent talks about that all day, it's naturally going to be absorbed by their children.
Have you seen those charts on mental health by political affiliation?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, you're definitely right that it is happening to some degree in conservative households too, but
it's definitely more on the liberal side.
It's
for sure.
Wild how big of a difference it is. It's like almost double the incidence or something, isn't it?
I actually have a theory about this.
Okay, go ahead.
I actually have a theory about this. I think on the liberal side, barring outside of Trump as an existential threat, all the other existential threats that are talked about, like climate, racism, they're like very abstract. Like there's no target. There's no like person who is the problem. And conservatives are, for better or worse, like very good at vilifying like one person. Like it's Biden's fault or it's Osama bin Laden or it is like whatever the Bill Gates. Like there's like a target of your ire. And like in a weird way, that's like more mentally healthy.
That's interesting.
It doesn't feel like this like amorphous environmental thing that's just like taking you on. It's like, no, this is the enemy.
Yeah, if I'm not, and, like, if I'm not in a room with Bill Gates, I'm okay. But... the climate is in the room with us.
or even if it's an industry, like it's the vaccine, like it's like a very clear target. Whereas, I mean, racism, it's like everything can expand into that. It's like, oh, the universities are racist. Math is racist. You know, the governments, everything's racist. Right. And like same thing with climate change. It's like everything can be affected by that. And you just probably feel like the walls are closing in in a way. I mean, it's a very scary position to be in.
It's a good point.
If you truly believe that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my theory about why like the liberals' fears are more scary to them, like relatively.
Yeah.
Even the abstract conservative fears like war on Christmas can be made tangible.
Yeah.
Well, and they're easier to fight back against.
Or the guns thing. Every time there's a school shooting and there's like talks about like being more strict with gun control, what do conservatives do? They go buy a lot more guns. There's like a tangible action
you can do,
they can go take. Like gun sales always spike after a shooting like that. And it's like, what are they doing? You actually feel better by taking an action.
That's a good point.
So you're no longer anxious. You're like, I got more guns now. Like they're going to have to come and take all of them. Yeah. Right. So you've done something that's like not a positive action, is not the right word, but you've taken an action. So you just feel like I've done something about it.
I buy it. There's something there.
There's something there to that. But yeah, Nat, I've seen those stats. It's crazy. Yeah. Like there's this, actually I have a highlight in here, which was, I think it was boys. It's something to the effect of like boys from a liberal household report higher degrees of depression than girls from conservative households, which is wild because girls generally have a much higher rate of that.
If you want your kids to be happy.
Oh yeah, here we go. Liberal teen boys evince worse depression than conservative teen girls.
Yeah, we've moved on.
We've moved on to the beer Republican section of the podcast. For your kid's sake. Okay, never mind. Let's skip that part of the podcast. The one thing I did want to talk about, though, I know we've been recording for a while, but like one thing I definitely want to talk about, I had no idea people do this, the screenshot thing.
Oh yeah,
people do this, dude.
Taking ammo.
People do this.
Yeah, that's crazy. People do that?
Yep.
So Adil, you said you've heard of other people doing this who are in school?
I have a handful of friends who did grad school at Ivy Leagues the last couple of years. Two of them reported that at two different schools and two different programs, there were people who were doing this. They were taking screenshots of things other people said. And in one case, I'm like being deliberately vague here, but in one case, this person actually had like dossier, like a set of folders and subfolders with like names and like was showing it to a small group at like a party.
Wow.
Which is just so
it's literally like McCarthyism.
Because it's one thing.
Yeah.
It's literally I love the allusions in the book to like, oh, like Stalin thought.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
But it's one thing when you're like, all right, it's like a middle school thing or even like a high school thing. Like people did petty shit when I was in high school too. Like maybe they didn't literally do this, but they did like equivalents. But these are like 25, 30-year-olds.
Yeah. It's crazy too, because like it's really a shame for relationships. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, but it's like the riskiness of your humor is one of the best ways to judge the closeness of a relationship. Right? Like we can all make the worst jokes possible with each other because we've known each other for so long and because we like can like trust each other. And that's kind of like how you judge trust in a relationship is like, it's an interesting human thing that we'll like, we'll make slightly edgy jokes to see how people react as a way to know like how well we can trust them. And if you are like always worried that somebody might screenshot something to use it against you, you never test those relationships. You never actually get deeper in that really important way, which is super sad, probably contributes to the like increasing loneliness and whatnot that also seems to be affecting young kids.
Even if it's not edgy humor, it's just like an innocuous mistake will get screenshot.
That too.
So you have very low trust.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, it's not only that I can't make a joke, like fine, I can police myself, but I literally can't slip. I can't say something that is accidentally, that could even be misconstrued. It's not even accidentally bad.
Yeah.
It's like sufficiently vague that it could be misconstrued. The last thing I'll say that I had in the notes that I wanted to touch on is that empathy can be bad.
Mm, yeah.
I thought this was actually a really big point. And it's like empathy is another one of those things where we've said it's good at all costs. But I think what she rightfully points out is that empathy can be good, but it can also be bad because empathy is necessarily focusing on a specific individual. And in cases where it's not clear who's right or wrong, or there's like a bunch of people involved, you actually want to be fair to everybody involved, especially in the case she gives as an example of, you know, one high school kid inadvertently hurting another high school kid. In the story, actually, the second one being hurt is kind of stretching the story and shouldn't really be hurt by it.
Yeah.
But the school, in an attempt to show empathy to the hurt high school kid, was basically extremely cruel to the other one. Like, I mean, I thought that story was going to end with like a high school suicide story.
Yeah, I thought so
that too. Level of being ostracized would have, yeah, it's really, really rough.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
that was like a struggle session.
Yeah, it was definitely a struggle session.
Yep.
I generally feel optimistic that if this book is coming out, like the culture is starting to move against some of this, and we might see a shift from, I think this is like a hyper feminine approach to like interpersonal conflict resolution and whatnot, like what's been done for the last 10 years. Right. And it feels like it's shifting more masculine again. And like, again, just sort of like bouncing between these two polarities. Right. But I do feel optimistic that it's going to, there could be like a happier middle ground than the two extremes that we've seen so far.
What we have now or what we had before.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like we were raised in what I would call a good middle ground.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, I'll just speak for myself. Different in every household, but yeah.
It felt like, yeah. I mean, there definitely wasn't any of the like emotional awareness that we have today. Like that's what I feel like was missing. There wasn't any of the like crazy nonsense that there is today too, but there wasn't good like communication around a lot of it. Was
I suppose that area it could have been improved.
Yeah, it was like pure ignore it or suck it up. There wasn't like so much of a middle ground, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think one other thing that she mentioned that's related to this point with kids is it's not social media that's necessarily at fault, which I think you hear a lot, right? Of like, that's what's different now.
It's not the phones. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the phones probably play a role in like the rapid social spreading of some of this stuff. Like there were some sections early in the book where she was mentioning like kids almost feel left out if they don't have something going on, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If they don't have a mental health disorder or something.
Like. Yeah. So I think social media does play a role in some of it, but I don't think that's like the main culprit here, was one of my takeaways.
Well, she did say if you're like a serious high school counselor, then the first thing, it's sort of like if you're a serious nurse and you bring in a patient who is smoking, you're going to say, stop smoking.
No, that's true. I think that is a good point. Yeah.
And she said the same thing for phones, but yeah, I don't think it's the cause. It seems like it's exacerbating
amplifier
potentially every single part of it, but not,
it's like a multiplier
cause. Yeah.
There's one other element of it that she didn't get into too much, but that I've heard elsewhere that's really interesting, which is like particularly among white people, there's this fixation on having like a disability or a disorder because like white kids especially have been told that like they're the problem in society, right? Like white people are bad, right? And so like you're part of the like oppressor class. And so they're latching onto these disabilities or disorders or whatnot as a way to say like, oh no, there's something like bad or disadvantaged about me too. Like I'm not one of the like bad people, which is why you see like an often disproportionate amount of representation of kids like having these symptoms and disorders in like young white kids. She didn't get into it that much. I've heard it talked about elsewhere, but that's another thing that I'd be like curious to see more about.
Or like more about the stats on that and like
yeah.
I mean I've anecdotally noticed that too, but
it makes sense. I don't, there's only so much you can go to a kid and be like, hey, everything wrong is your fault because you're white. And it's like, I'm 15.
Yeah. You know, like, yeah. I just got here.
Like, I mean, that's.
All right.
This was a great choice, Nat.
This is a great book. I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a 2 hours that flew by.
Yeah, seriously. And we didn't even like get to most of it, but.
Everyone should pick this up and give it a read.
I think so. Yeah.
Let us know what you think. You can comment directly in Spotify. Curious to hear what people thought of the book and the episode. I think there's probably some people that disagree with us. There's probably some things the author maybe left out in the book, as always happens.
Comment on YouTube too. Right? Yep. We're gonna put the video up on YouTube. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
If you want to see us talking about it, be up there.
Vote for the cuter of my two cats.
Yeah, exactly. cool. And then next book is Einstein's Dreams.
Einstein's Dreams, while we make our way through 800 pages of the First World War.
Dude, it's a long
should we
book.
Should we do the three body problem show episode?
Oh, yeah, we could do that too. Einstein's Dreams? Yeah.
Let's do that one first because while it's fresh.
Yeah. Is everybody done?
I'm still only four episodes in, so, but I'll get done.
Yeah, you'll be done by the time we record.
Yeah, it'll be in 2 weeks, so it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Sweet.
I'll save my thoughts for the episode.
Cool. Alrighty. See you guys. See y'all next week.
See you next time.